I'm David Martin Davies, and coming up on The Source, if you've ever been to a Mayan ruin site in Mexico or Central America, you are sure to experience the feelings of awe and wonder. How were these amazing structures built, and why were they abandoned? You may have asked yourself, if only these ancient walls could speak. Well, they do speak. We just didn't know how to hear them, or actually how to read the glyph writings that were carved into the stone. But now we do. In recent decades, the Maya code has been cracked, and we have the history of the Maya people told to us from their own perspective. And many of the mysteries are being answered about their politics, their wars, and their overall story. There were no ancient alien space travelers. The story is much more down-to-earth and real. That's what's coming up on The Source, but first, this news.
Support for The Source podcast comes from UT Health San Antonio, South Texas' largest academic research institution, where what is discovered in its labs translates into life-changing patient care. More at uthealthsa.org.
Live from the John L. Santico studio in downtown San Antonio, this is The Source from Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. For a long time, the ancient Maya were cast in popular culture as a kind of mystery. A brilliant civilization built great cities and then simply disappeared. But that story is changing dramatically. A major breakthrough in the decipherment of Maya hieroglyphic writing is now allows scholars to read much more of what the Maya recorded about themselves. What has emerged is not a vanishing people wrapped in a myth, but a complex and deeply human history of dynasties, warfares, alliances, ritual, and political struggles. In his new book, The Four Heavens, A New History of the Ancient Maya, archaeologist and epigrapher David Stewart draws on a revolution in scholarship to tell us a new story of the Maya world, one shaped by rival kingdoms, powerful royal houses, and the voices of the Maya themselves, speaking across centuries through inscriptions once thought to be unreadable. David Stewart is the director of the Mesoamerican Center at the University of Texas at Austin. He joins us to talk about what we're only now beginning to understand about the ancient Maya. And David, welcome to The Source.
Thanks for having me.
Our phone lines are open. If you got a question or a comment, got a story to tell us about going to a Maya ruin, give us a call. 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. So we're using the word Maya. Is that a good word to be using to talk about these people? Did they see themselves as one people, all these different kingdoms, cities?
Well, you know, it's a great question. We use the word Maya in this really broad collective sense for the whole culture and civilization, but that usage is pretty recent. That's only in the last 100, 150 years. The Maya in ancient times probably identified themselves more with their own places, their own kingdoms and communities. But at the same time, you know, they knew they were all related, and they were related. That's what the history is now telling us. And I think they did have a sense of kind of collective, you know, self or identity of some sort. The word Maya is actually something that I think we can track down in the ancient inscriptions. And it may have been a place name originally for, you know, what we now call basically the Yucatan Peninsula, which was sort of its use at the time of the Spanish conquest and invasion. So, yeah, Maya, the word Maya has changed its meaning over the centuries quite a bit.
And when we use it today, what are we referring to?
We're referring to a few things. We can refer to the ancient civilization as a whole, a lot like saying ancient Egypt or ancient Greece. We can refer to the modern people who speak Mayan languages, because there are a lot of speakers of those languages today, more than 4 or 5 million in Guatemala, Mexico, Belize, many speakers even here in the United States, in the immigrant population, whose first language is a Mayan language. So, you know, it's used culturally, linguistically, you know, historically to refer to, you know, this legacy. It's really a term about this, you know, this remarkable culture in its many iterations, its many flavors.
So we the Spanish conquistadors, explorers, that they came to the Yucatan, they would see these magnificent abandoned cities. They would go to the people who were living on the outskirts of them in huts and things and say, who built these? And the people would say, what?
Well, when the Spanish arrived, many of these cities were still around, in fact. I mean, the Spanish were, in fact, astounded by many of the communities they saw. The famous ruins of Tulum, for example, may have actually been witnessed from the ocean by Spanish sailors. But you're right, there were a lot of abandoned cities. And, you know, this has been the mystery for a long time. And frankly, it was the mystery for a lot of the Maya people who lived a few hundred years ago, as you say, at the time of the Spanish invasion. So they sometimes didn't have a sense of their own deeper history. I mean, these were cities that sometimes had been abandoned for many centuries. And the local memories of these places had been lost. This is something that's kind of surprising to a lot of us, you know, that you wouldn't know exactly who these people were, even though they were Maya people from long ago. So, you know, in the 1800s, when some of the early explorers were, you know, using machetes and hacking their way through the forests and finding these astounding lost cities, the Maya people who were sometimes helping these guys and guiding them around, you know, they would wonder too, who built these, right? It was a mystery to a lot of people. So it's a kind of complicated thing. There were some, I think, areas where they acknowledged, yeah, these are our ancestors. There were other areas where people felt disconnected from their past because of the conquest.
And then the conquest eroded what history they did have.
Yes, exactly. So, you know, one of the things that we need to think about is how before the Spanish, there were already a series of crises and collapses of the culture and the civilization. So, you know, the Spanish arrive in the 16th century. What we call the classic Maya, this is the, you know, when most of the big cities were built, when the writing system was being used a lot, that whole culture lasted for many centuries, but it collapsed around 800 to 900 AD, so several centuries before. So I think in Maya history, there's this double whammy, right, of the collapse of these great kingdoms. The Maya adapt and they reformulate, but then the Spanish arrive. And so history's lost in these different stages, right? It's lost, you know, when the kingdoms collapse and people basically abandon and walk away from these cities and do other things. And then you have what's left being stamped out by the conquistadors.
But it's amazing that people would leave these sites. I mean, they have structures. They had water systems. They had, you know, things that you could use to reuse to build new buildings. Why didn't that happen?
Well, this is the great mystery, the collapse or the abandonment of these cities. And, you know, there are some big sites we're talking about here, some very famous ancient Maya ruins, places like Tikal in Guatemala or Palenque in Mexico. Calakmul, Copan, Chichen Itza up in Yucatan, Uxmal. I mean, I could go on and on and on. And these are the cities that have different histories. This happens in different ways locally, but generally by about 900, by 1000 AD, they are abandoned. And they're actually trees growing on these pyramids and palaces. So what happened, right? And this is the great question we've been asking.
Right, I think, we're going to get into that. We've got to take a break here. It's a great teaser. So we're going to tell you answer.
Keep talking.
So what happened to all those people in those fantastic Maya cities? And you can call in with your questions and comments. I do want to hear about stories from people. I've been to many of these sites myself, and they were moving. So just magical places. Call in with your stories, 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. The Four Heavens, a new history of the Maya, the ancient Maya. More of that on The Source right after this.
Support for this podcast of The Source comes from Texas Mutual Insurance Company, a workers' compensation provider committed to rewarding policyholders who keep their workers safe and losses low. More at texasmutual.com/TXM Advantage. Texas Mutual. Texans get it.
You're listening to The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. With us, the author of the new book, The Four Heavens, A New History of the Ancient Maya, David Stewart. He is an explorer, like Indiana Jones in kind of a way. But he has been actually exploring the language of the Maya glyphs, breaking them down, breaking through what these glyphs are, what they're saying, what they're telling us about the people who lived at these amazing cities now in what we call Mexico and Central America. Got a question or a comment, give us a call, 833-877-8255. When we went to break, David, you were telling us that some of the mysteries are now, the mist is lifting. We're finding out more.
Well, we definitely are. I mean, we've been studying, as archaeologists and scholars, historians, we've been studying this civilization now for, you know, a good 100 years. And so we know a lot. There is a lot we still don't know. And, you know, there is mystery, frankly, this collapse, this abandonment, which happened very fast, you know, between 800 and 900. This is still something that I think we'll be wrestling with, you know, for a long time. I don't know if we'll ever know the exact circumstances behind it, but we know that there were climate issues, population densities, which were big stressors on these communities. And there was endemic warfare. This is what the history is really showing us, is how this was a society at war with itself. At least the elites, you know, the royal courts were really, you know, having a hard time of it, let's say in the very last decades of the 8th century AD. So, you know, we know the history in a way that is remarkable, and that's changed in the last 40, 50 years.
I have a question from a listener email. He asked, in his book, The Four Heavens, David Stewart describes the many instances where the different Mayan city-states fought against and conquered each other. Does he have any idea how many fighters were involved in these battles?
That's a great question. The short answer is not really. When we read about their wars, and there are many records of these things, we have the timing of them. We know the days they happened. We know which communities were fighting which communities. We don't get the details of like the numbers of soldiers or the natures of they're not descriptions of the battles. You know, we wish we had those kinds of things. So, you know, we have to rely on other kinds of sources for that. We can study warfare through imagery. There's some beautiful representations on wall paintings and also on ceramic vessels of, you know, fancily clad warriors, actual battle scenes painted, the famous murals at the site of Bonampak down in Mexico show a raging battle between two different Maya kingdoms. And it's, you know, they're all dressed in these wonderful, beautiful outfits, but they're just fighting each other. And
what kind of weapons, you know, did they use? Did they, I mean, well, I remember clubs with obsidian stuck in them?
Yeah. So they had mostly, you know, what we see in the imagery are warriors with long spears and obsidian knives and flint. They didn't have metal weaponry. They had metal technology late in Maya civilization, but not for tools and weapons. So, you know, they were fierce warriors. They had fierce looking weapons, shields, and also well-dressed, I have to say. You had to be really, you know, in the armor that they had. You know, they had amazing jaguar pelts and headdresses and things that they battled in.
And so the language, the glyphs actually reflect a spoken language. So it's not just imagery, hieroglyphs that we associate with Egypt. It's more of a spoken language reflected in that?
Yeah. So the decipherment of Maya writing is a long story, and the code was cracked more or less in the 1970s and 80s. And that's pretty recent, actually, when you think about it. And it is a language. We borrow the word hieroglyphs from Egyptology. There's no connection between the two. But if you look at a Maya text, you know, whether it's carved on a stone tablet or whether it's painted in a book or on a piece of pottery, you know, it's gorgeous. It's really ornate, beautiful, very fluid, very, you know, representations of animal heads and you know, hands and things we can recognize, a lot of things we can't recognize at first. And the complexity, the visual complexity of this writing was a big distraction, because underneath all of it is a writing system, and it's all language. It's words and sounds that we can link up with the Mayan languages spoken today. We can identify the grammar. We can read off these texts as if they were spoken. And that's an incredible thing to be able to do, right? So luckily Mayan languages are still quite vibrant and still being spoken. That allows us to understand the inscriptions.
When what's in the inscription is, I imagine they don't talk about the common people. It's the story of the royalty. And I would imagine it's kind of like trying, if someone thousands of years ago tried to figure out what our civilization was like based on the tweets of Donald Trump.
Oh, God. Yeah, I guess it would be a pretty narrow slice of the world we live in, right? Yeah, absolutely. The Maya inscriptions are the voices of the royal courts and of the scribes in those courts. And their official documents, right? We don't have the everyday kind of correspondences or emails or tweets of a Maya ruler. But, you know, the way I look at it is, as long as we recognize that these are the records of the 1%, you might say, sure, that is a narrow slice of the culture and the civilization. But boy, are we lucky to have it, right? We have something to study. It gives us this broad outline of the histories and everything. And I wish we knew more about everyday life from these written sources. But, you know, maybe someday we'll get more of that, but it's hard to say.
Any business dealings, you know, in other ancient languages, we find out who owed who X amount of goods. Anything like that?
Well, yeah, you know, in the broader ancient world, economic records like that are pretty common. If you go to Mesopotamia or even to Egypt, you know, you can get these economic records and basically receipts, right, for transactions. We don't really have that. These probably existed to some extent, but they were on paper. That doesn't survive in this tropical environment of Central America. What we do have are a few records here and there of people paying tribute to each other, you know, paying each other and making offerings and jade and these exotic materials that would kind of be the economic goods
of
the royalty. Chocolate, exactly. So cacao, which is a Mayan word that we've kind of borrowed, cocoa, that is talked about quite a bit. In fact, a lot of the ceramics we have writing on them. Sometimes they say, this is so-and-so's drinking cup for cacao. Because chocolate existed as a drink. It didn't exist as bars or as candy.
I mean, it was a spicy drink, not sweet.
Yeah, it was usually kind of hot and spiced up or sweetened with honey. You know, this was a really popular, well, in, you know, past the time of the conquest and even in rituals today, ritual chocolate drink is important in some parts of Guatemala and Central America. And yeah, it can be very tasty stuff, but different from our chocolate.
Let's go to a caller, 833-877-8255. And Randall, you're on the air. Go ahead.
I heard a call for stories. So I don't know if this is worth repeating, but here we go. It was December of 2016. I was married at the time. We went on a 7-day cruise 1 week before Christmas. It was a carnival cruise from Galveston that kind of went around the area of the Gulf of Mexico there. And on that cruise, we got to visit two sites as part of the day excursions that those cruises always have. The first one, I don't remember exactly where we disembarked, what the port was, but we took a 2-hour bus ride to Chichen Itza, sometimes called the Stonehenge of the Western Hemisphere, I think. And it was okay. There was a traffic issue during the 2-hour bus ride and on the way there, and we only ended up having like an hour to visit the site. Very impressive. Also kind of cheesy because it was overrun with these cheap souvenir tables and all that. So kind of like more the Playland Park of the Mayan ruins, I guess, by now, maybe. I don't know. But 2 days later, we docked off the coast of Belize, and we got to visit the Lamanai ruins. That was phenomenal. That's the one where you grab your fedora and your bullwhip and your machete almost. We rode this rickety old school bus for about 90 minutes into the interior to this lakeside cantina, and then we got off, or riverside, I guess. We got into 2 or 3 boats. These were like these big speed boats, and we traveled down and across the river. It was about a 20-25 minute trip. We disembarked onto this rickety old wooden pier. We followed this trail into the jungle, and then suddenly you step out into this clearing, and
huge buildings, amazing.
We got to climb to the top of the high temple. There's a wooden stairway that goes around the back, but then when you get like 90% of the way up, you have to sort of like climb up, and everybody was making sure everybody else didn't go over the edge. But you get to the top, and you can see the treetops of the jungle, and you can see the new river off to one side. That was really, really something, and it's amazing to see something like that that's older, centuries older than you, and it's still there. And anybody who's listening, who, you know, if you've got, you need to be, you know, kind of physically able to do this, because there's some walking and some climbing and some things like that. But man, if you can do it, that's just amazing stuff to see. It really is.
Yeah. Well, Randall, David, thank you for that. Great description. David Stewart, your reaction?
Yeah. No, I mean, it is magical. I just listening to the enthusiasm of Randall, you know, remembering his visits to Lamanai in Belize. I've been there. I've been on that river. I've been doing exactly the same walk that he did. These are really atmospheric places. I would encourage anyone to get down to the Maya world if they haven't been there already. Get off the beaten track too. Get off road. There are sites everywhere. You know, I was just in Guatemala 2 weeks ago and visited some really remote sites, but you know, some that are really easy to get to too, and they are mind-blowing. I still get chills whenever I visit Tikal or Palenque. These are very emotional places for reasons I'm not quite sure. You, David, were explaining something like that too.
Oh yeah, Palenque, I was there in the mid-80s, spent a lot of time there, and before they kind of locked it down, so you're able to do a lot of exploring on your own and crawling through little tunnels and just being amazed by the entirety of it all and wondering what has not been uncovered yet. And there's still a lot at Palenque that is still underground and yet to be understood and looked at and deciphered, and there's a lot more to learn. We're going to take a break here, and you can call in. I'm going to get Jeff on the air. The number is 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. And we are speaking with David Stewart. He is a professor of Mesoamerican art and writing and the director of the Mesoamerican Center at the University of Texas at Austin. His book is The Four Heavens, A New History of the Ancient Maya. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. We'll be back. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. We're talking about the new book, The Four Heavens, A New History of the Ancient Maya. We're with the author, David Stewart, and he is the director of Mesoamerica Center at the University of Texas at Austin. Let's go to Jeff on the phones, 833-877-8255, if you want to call in. And Jeff, you're on the air.
Hey, thank you. Professor, I was wondering if there's still people around that speak the language, couldn't they be consulted to help decipher some of these codes and writings? I'll take my answer offline. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Jeff.
Well, yes, absolutely. The speakers of Mayan languages, as I mentioned, are, you know, in the millions. Now, there are a lot of different languages, right? So the language that is most relevant or most, you know, closest to the ancient language that we read, these are spoken by not a great many people today in Guatemala and in Mexico, but absolutely, we consult all the time with native speakers. There are scholars who are Maya today in the last couple of generations, who are archaeologists, who grew up studying archaeology, who speak Mayan languages as well. So, it's a different world from when I started. It's wonderful to see this. And I think the realization by modern Maya people that they're beginning to see that they have this legacy. I think it's been inspiring to some to get into the field of archaeology and history and to embrace it and to start to own it, right?
I see that there are some workshops for young people to learn the language and the writing of the language. There is an effort to reclaim it and bring it to the next generation.
That's right. Yeah. You know, these workshops in studying the hieroglyphs in particular, they really started here in Texas. They started in Austin back in the late 1970s. And they've grown from there. I remember back in the 90s, 80s and 90s, we would have teachers come from Guatemala and from Mexico to Austin to take part in our workshops. They would go back and do their own. And sometimes I and my colleagues would join them. And so these have kind of taken off, right? And so kids are really getting into this. I mean, this is how I got into it.
You have a great story. So your dad was like the head of the Geographic Society.
Well, he was a editor and writer for National Geographic. So I grew up in that kind of world.
Stomping around Palenque when you were just a kid.
Yeah, I was in Palenque in the 70s and 80s. And, you know, that's kind of one of my hometowns down there is Palenque. When he was working as an archaeologist also, because he was an archaeologist, he had a PhD and all that. We were in sites, you know, working. He would be working and drag the family along, and I'd be down there, and you know, I'd be wandering around these sites, kind of on my own as a 10-year-old kid. And you know, I'd kind of wonder about it, but I wasn't that serious about it. But then when he started finding tablets with glyphs on them, you know, I'd ask him, "Hey, Dad, what do those say?" And he's like, "I don't know. Nobody can read them," you know. And that just got me, right? I was like, "Well, what are they say?" And I had to read up on it. So I got early on, you know, really into the visuals of the writing, and this is what appeals to kids today too. I think they almost look like little cartoons, right? So I would draw them at school, you know, doodles and all that kind of thing. Instead of Pokemon, I was into Maya glyphs or something like that. And it appeals to kids. And I think this is important for getting the modern Maya educators and kids inspired.
Let's go to Arturo on the phones. And Arturo, you're on the air.
Hi, good. Hello. Thanks for taking my call. Mine is not a deep question, but I'll be brief. I grew up in Puerto Rico. I speak Spanish like we speak in the Caribbean. And then I married a beautiful lady here in San Antonio, Texas, Mexican-American. The family has been here for years and years. But anyway, she wanted her daughter, her daughter to be named Xochitl, X-O-C-H-I-T-L. And I cannot believe she's 15 now. I heard, oh, it's Mayan or Aztec, and I never researched. And then when I heard the show today, I go, wait a minute. So my question is, do you know the origin of that name?
Yes, I do.
Thank you for your question, Arturo. Appreciate that.
Yeah, thank you. Xochitl is not a Mayan word. It's actually Nahuatl, which is a whole other language that was spoken by the Aztecs. And it's still spoken today by Nahuatl speakers in Mexico. So Xochitl, it's a name I hear from time to time. It means flower, a flower blossom. And it was a very important word in a lot of rituals for the Aztecs. It was one of the names of the days of their calendar was Xochitl. So it's a wonderful name to have, I think.
Back to Palenque, the great king of Palenque, is it Pakal?
Pakal, yeah.
And so he was the king there from age of 12 to 80. Many people may have seen this image through the Chariot of the Gods, where it's supposedly a Mayan spaceship, but it's actually his burial. Talk about that.
Yes, so we're talking about one of the great kings of Maya history. We call him Pakal. His full name was Kinichhanab Pakal. And you gave him the dates there. He ruled in the 7th century. And so back in 1952, an archaeologist working in Palenque found this amazing crypt, a burial chamber beneath the main pyramid that one sees at Palenque, the Temple of the Inscriptions. And the archaeologist, Alberto Rus, opens up this door and he peers inside, and there's this amazing carved kind of table that he can't quite make out. But it's got this image on the top of it, of this, in the center, there's this reclining portrait of a Maya ruler. And a lot of complex imagery around him. It's impossible to describe, you know, verbally. But this thing was hard to interpret, frankly. There was no history when Rus opened that tomb. You know, in other words, he didn't know who it was. The decipherment of the name came much, much later in the 1980s. So that left a void. That left a void that was filled in by some cranks like Eric Von Daniken, the guy who came up with this idea that it was a spaceship, you know, this astronaut, ancient astronaut guy taking off or something like that. And that's just all nonsense. I mean, we now know who it is. It's Pakal. It's showing him being resurrected in death. He's what the Maya call entering the path or entering the road, which means he's joining the sun on its daily cycles in the heavens. And so it's this image of Maya, the Maya conception of how a king transforms from life to death.
How active were human sacrifices with the Mayans? As I understand it, there was a site, ATM in Belize, where they have the remnants of human sacrifices. That's according to someone who I was just talking to just now about that.
Yeah. There are there's direct evidence of sacrificial offerings that we have. We find them in lots of different contexts, and you know, this is something that people have debated. You know, did the Maya have sacrifice, or was this kind of exaggerated later on by the Spanish? The Aztecs also, of course, are known for this, and yes, they did have human sacrifice. There's no question. And, you know, it's hard maybe for us to wrap our heads around this, but the what I see in the historical records and in the art is that a lot of these things we call human sacrifice, they're more like, you know, executions of captured prisoners and things like that, right? They're ritual performances that all cultures do in the ancient past. And so, yeah, it's violent. It's hard to, you know, study.
Or could it especially be like prisoners, lawbreakers?
Prisoners, yeah, prisoners as slaves, captured people.
We kind of do that in Texas, so yeah.
Well, there you go, right? I mean, I have a colleague long ago made the point that, you know, the death penalty is a form of institutionalized sacrifice of a person to the greater justice system or something like that, right? So there's kind of a fine line there, I guess, in some ways. But humans are violent, and we've come up with excuses all the time to dispatch other people, unfortunately.
All right, so coming up on another break, but when we come back, I want to ask you about the Mayan calendar. Why were they so obsessed with time and apparently the end of the world? And we're going to take some more questions from callers. So we'll get Quentin on the air. And if you got a question, give us a call, 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. The Source continues after this break. You're listening to The Source on Texas Public Radio. We're talking about the history of the Maya with David Stewart. His book is The Four Heavens. Let's go to Quentin on the phones. And Quentin, you're on the air. Yes. Go ahead, Quentin. Go ahead.
Hello.
Yes.
I have a good story, very short. Been to Chichen Itza, Palenque, Tikal, Copan. They're all incredible sites. They're beautiful. So incredible. It's amazing. But I worked in a dig in Belize, and what we were trying to find was obsidian, because you can connect obsidian to specific places. So we were calling it the Mayan Road. If anybody has anything to say about that, then the Mayan Road would be that there were trade routes between all the different cities. And then also in Tikal, there were all these little minor temples, but they were all around a ball court. And the ball court was a place where people settled their differences between different warring factions within the Mayan community. Plus, the Mayans are beautiful.
So. Well, Quentin, thank you for the call. David, there's a lot there.
Yeah, no, I agree. obsidian. Quentin was on a dig. This is something that a lot of my colleagues and I, to some extent, study, which is these communication routes and connections between different areas in within the Maya region and also beyond, right? So the Maya were great traders. They had a lot of raw materials in their environment. Obsidian was up in the volcanic highlands of Guatemala and also up in central Mexico. And so, you know, we don't think about it much, but if you don't have metal to have a basic tool that you can cut things with, obsidian is great. It's a really sharp material. And so you find it all the time at places like Chichen Itza or in Belize where there isn't obsidian naturally, right? So they had to bring it in and trade it from far away. The ball game, the ball courts that Quentin mentioned, yeah, they're at Tikal. They're at a lot of Maya sites. We find them. They're big ones. They're small ones. I see them as kind of like performance spaces. There were games for sure, but there was also, you know, we have images of these fantastic contests between richly clad rulers and warriors and players, where they're dressed up so much it's almost like it was impossible for them to play ball, right? And so there's a theatrical part to that game that I think is really interesting. But it's connected to the politics and the rituals and the warfare going on for sure.
And then other cultures and civilizations also play the same game.
Yeah, it was found throughout Mesoamerica. These ball courts, this long playing alley, sometimes with two stone rings on the sides, we find those all throughout the Maya region, but also, you know, the Aztecs had the same game, and down in Oaxaca and, you know, other parts of Mexico. So it was all over Mesoamerica. It was important for clearly the elites and probably the everyday folks too, but integrated into their palaces and into their temples in a way that I find really interesting.
And Brandon, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Yeah, well, and you know, one of the reasons the cities may have become abandoned is that what Europeans learned in the Middle Ages, that and when you put people in close proximity, they develop diseases, and the diseases wipe them out. Is that the case there in Central America?
All right, Brandon, thank you for the call. So, David?
Yeah, I think that was a factor from time to time. It's hard to study the pathogens archaeologically. We see the results of them sometimes in the skeletons, depending on what kinds of pathogens there are. And there are people who specialize in the study of this. How much it affected the greater population and how much it may have led to people leaving communities and migrating and so forth, that's hard to say. That's hard to track.
But they did have a water system. The quarries, I understand that they would excavate to build the temples and things, and that would also create a water system, which was graded in a way that the water, clean water, would flow in, and the gray water would flow out.
Yeah, so there's some amazing hydraulic engineering that the Maya certainly did. With natural springs or collecting water runoff. In where some of these cities are found today, there's no water. I mean, it's hard for an archaeological project.
They're not near rivers.
Yeah, some of these sites are out in the middle of nowhere, and there are no rivers and there are no lakes. There were in the past, but the environment has changed, right? So we have a hard time getting water when we're out in the boonies digging these sites sometimes. So water, I think, is a key part of the whole story. The changing dynamics of water and its overuse, how it's affected by people and the landscape over time. I think the Maya in ancient times were experiencing these problems directly in different ways. And so there's some lessons there, I'm sure, for the modern world and the world here in Texas, where water is a big deal, too.
Now let's go to Henry, and Henry, you're on the air.
Howdy. I was wondering, what elements of the Mayan culture diffused into the Spanish colonial period and that nature, and do we still see today in Mexico?
Thank you for the call, Henry. David?
Yeah, wonderful question. I think this gets underplayed. There's a huge influence. You have to remember that, you know, in the 1500s, in that first, say, 100 years of Spanish presence in New Spain, what's now Mexico, the Spanish populations, the European populations, were vastly outnumbered by the indigenous. Even though the indigenous populations were going through their own turmoil of, you know, disease and the effects of this exchange were pretty traumatic. But the influence is everywhere. And I think the way you see it mostly is in food. The food of Mexico is the food of Mesoamerica. It's changed. You know, there's influences from other parts of the world, from the Middle East and from the Philippines, and all of this kind of contributed to Mexican cuisine. But, you know, we were talking about cacao. We were talking about other kinds of important trade goods. And the Spanish tapped into that immediately. They wanted chocolate. They wanted, and took it back to Europe, and it took off, right? They wanted these amazing foods that they found in Tenochtitlan, in the Aztec capital, and in Guatemala. Very rich places for agriculture, right? So the legacy of Mesoamerica is, I think, found throughout the world today. especially in what we eat and what we drink.
Were the Mayans as obsessed with time as we think that they were?
In a way, they wrote about time a lot because they were wanting to put their history and their rituals. They wanted to anchor all of that properly in time. So we understand their calendar really well. It's really sophisticated. We can correlate their calendar with ours so we can find out when things actually happened in our sense of time. So yeah, it's an amazing kind of, I don't know, when you look at the extent of their conception of time, it almost gets very philosophical because they're talking about all these cycles that end and begin again and end and begin again, and the scales of these things are amazing. You know, we take time for granted, but they saw it as cosmic. They saw it as cosmology and as animate, as a living thing in their own world.
But didn't they predict that the world would come to an end or a new cycle would begin in, what, 2012?
Yeah, so many of the listeners will remember maybe 2012 and all the brouhaha that happened around then, right? So the reality is the Maya never said anything about the end of the world. That day in 2012, now a ways back for us, December 21st or 23rd, depending on the calendar correlation, you know, there were a lot of people really worried. I remember I was getting calls and emails all the time from folks who were, you know, all over the world, and they were concerned if the Maya really said the world was going to end. And I would say, no, they never said this. This was a misconception that kind of came out in some books in the 70s, especially, that kind of predicted this. But the Maya saw the end of a time cycle and the beginning of a new one. So it was a time of renewal more than the end of everything. And I think that was an important message I tried to get out to people back then. You know, for those that listened, I mean, there were not many.
But. Did we just get the date wrong? Is there a date when they said the world's going to come to an end?
Not really, no. I mean, the calendar's chugging along. You know, if you crunch the numbers, there's really no end to it because their sense of time, the years in the, you know, categories of time that they embedded in their calendar are far bigger than ours. So, you know, their sense of when the cosmos began is way before our Big Bang.
Yeah.
And I think it just keeps going.
You know? A lot to learn there. A lot of inspiration. Well, David Stewart, thank you so much. The book is The Four Heavens, A New History of the Ancient Maya. It was great talking to you. I appreciate that.
Thanks so much, David. It was fun.
That's The Source on Texas Public Radio. David Martin Davies. Thanks for listening.
This has been The Source on Texas Public Radio. The Source is hosted by David Martin Davies. Tim Gutierrez is the show's producer. Additional production support from Steve Short, Ruben Garcia, Yvette Benavides, and Dan Katz, Vice President of News. The Source is made possible with support from the Gladys and Ralph Lazarus Foundation.